News. I'm Christopher Cruz reporting. The Trump administration says it will soon pull all American troops out of Syria, exposing a divide between President Trump and his military advisors. Associated Press Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports now from the Pentagon.
Just last week, the U.S. envoy to the Anti-Islamic State Coalition said the militants were being battered in Syria, but still pose a threat.
Nobody is declaring a mission accomplished.
But President Trump is, tweeting, "We have defeated ISIS in Syria." A U.S. official says all the roughly 2,000 American troops there will start leaving as soon as possible. The move blindsided lawmakers like Marco Rubio.
It's a terrible mistake, and unfortunately, I think we're going to pay a price for it if it's not reversed.
The president's long pushed to withdraw the troops, but military advisors have warned the militants could regroup without Americans on the ground.
Syrian Kurdish allies of the United States reacted with alarm on Wednesday at the surprise announcement by President Trump about the American troop withdrawal from Syria. The administration has not detailed any withdrawal plan or explained how the United States will remain engaged in the conflict after its troops leave. But the decision could have immediate consequences for the tense relations between Kurdish and Turkish troops in the region. They say a rapid withdrawal will leave them vulnerable to an offensive that Turkey has threatened to launch against them east of the Euphrates River. The Trump administration is placing more sanctions on Russian officials and entities for election interference and what the Treasury Department calls other malign activities. Among those sanctioned are 15 military intelligence agents and 4 government entities, including the Internet Research Agency. Those sanctioned are also accused of hacking the World Anti-Doping Agency, among others. This is VOA News. The Islamic State terrorist group may be defeated in the Middle East, but radical extremism is spreading to other parts of the world, and a new crop of potential terrorists, now in prison, will be out in a few years. Correspondent Lisa Bryant reports for VOA from Paris that the Secretary General of the world's top police body, Interpol, delivered that warning Wednesday.
Interpol Secretary General Jürgen Stock says a second wave of radicals linked to the Islamic State group and other organizations may soon emerge from jail. Inmates serving relatively short sentences for lesser terrorism-related charges who become hardened in prison.
These generation of early supporters or early terrorists will be released in the next couple of years. So in 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 years, we will see a wave of those who need to be released and will, of course, again, perhaps be part of a terrorist group or those who are supporting terrorist activity.
Despite de-radicalization experiments in several countries, Stock says prisons remain a top incubator for radical ideology.
China and the United States have traded criticisms again over trade, this time at a meeting in Europe. Associated Press correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
The spat at the World Trade Organization involved U.S. Ambassador Dennis Hsieh accusing China of theft of technology and an envoy from Beijing retorting that the U.S. was finger-pointing. This latest standoff comes as many countries lined up to criticize and question Trump administration policies in a WTO trade policy review of the U.S. Ambassador Hsieh has sought to redirect attention on China, saying it would subsidize its industries to squeeze foreign producers and dump products at cheap prices abroad.
The New York Times newspaper is reporting that Facebook's sharing of private data has been far more extensive than the company has admitted. Associated Press correspondent Warren Levinson reports.
The Times report says Facebook shared users' data with more than 150 companies, not just tech firms like Amazon and Microsoft, but automakers and media companies, for example, even if users had disabled sharing. The connections date back to 2010. Some remained active as late as this year. Facebook let Microsoft's search engine, Bing, see the names of Facebook users' friends without consent. A Russian search site, Yandex, had access to unique IDs until last year. The Times says it saw more than 270 pages of Facebook documents. The company responded in a blog post that nearly all the partnerships the paper wrote about have been shut down.
You can find more on these and other late-breaking and developing stories from around the world, around the clock, at voanews.com and on the VOA News mobile app. I'm Christopher Cruz, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today is Thursday, December 20th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. We have two more days to go before Congo's decisive presidential election. The governor of Kinshasa has banned campaigning in the capital.
Why he has to prevent me running my campaign and let other candidates run their own? It's an illegal decision, and my lawyer, they will go to court tomorrow to sue the governor.
Martin Fayulu is the presidential candidate of the coalition of opposition parties in the DRC. Togolese are voting today in a controversial parliamentary election. We'll talk with both the government and the opposition and East African community lawmakers urge Uganda to continue hosting refugees from the region.
The influx of refugees into Uganda has reached unprecedented levels that require an urgent need for the Council of Ministers to find and adopt permanent and urgent solution.
Victor Burukukiye is the chairman of the Committee on Regional Affairs and Conflict Resolution. Over 1,000 migrants have died in Africa this year alone, and power generators in Nigeria stand in the way of climate goals. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. With two more days to go before the decisive December 23rd presidential election in the Democratic Republic of Congo, the governor of Kinshasa has banned campaigning in the capital. Campaign was due to end at midnight tomorrow, Friday. Governor Andre Kimbuta, a member of Congo's ruling coalition, says the ban is necessary because he is in possession of information that extremists in the camps of the main candidates were preparing for street confrontation in Kinshasa. But Martin Fayulu, the presidential candidate of a coalition of four opposition parties, says the ban is an illegal ban targeted only towards him. He says his lawyers will go to court today to sue the mayor of Kinshasa.
That decision is not normal because during the campaign, everybody can run his campaign according to what the electoral law said, and no restriction at all. Why he has to prevent me running my campaign and let other candidates run their own? It's an illegal decision, and my lawyer, they will go to court tomorrow to sue the governor.
What do you hope to come out of the lawsuit?
Just to demonstrate that people cannot do what they want, because it's mentioned in our constitution that you are not forced to follow any order which you consider that is irregular.
Mr. Fayulu, you said that why is it that he's targeting you, but Governor Andre Kimbuta says he took the decision to suspend campaigning in Kinshasa because the security forces have information that extremists in all the political camps are preparing street confrontation.
But this is not true. Why they didn't do that in Lubumbashi or someone else? Why when I went to Lubumbashi, the governor of Lubumbashi took the decision to disturb my campaign? Why, when I went to Kalemi, the governor of Tanganyika did the same? Why the governor of Maniema prevented me to go to Kindu? Why others can go everywhere they want and Fayulu cannot? Why? Why the discrimination?
You and the other opposition candidates have access to the public media, say government television and radio?
They have access on everything they want. They can go everywhere they want. Fayulu cannot go where he wants. When I was in Kalemi, they disturbed my campaign. And I suppose after Kalemi to go to Lualaba, this is Kolwezi. To go to Kolwezi, they told me, no way, I cannot go to Kolwezi. And then I say, okay, I have to go back to Lubumbashi. And then tomorrow, I'll proceed to somewhere else. They say, even Lubumbashi, you cannot go. And I asked them why. I got the security guy, the top level security in this country. I got him on the phone. He told me you have only three airports that you can go in this country. This is Kinshasa, Goma, and Bukavu. Can you imagine? I'm not Congolese. I'm not a candidate. I don't have the same rights as others. I think there is something wrong. Kabila and the people, they are afraid of me. They didn't plan that situation. But the situation is there, and they cannot prevent it anymore. I'm there, and I have to run and I have to win this election, because what the Congolese are saying, it's clear that nobody can compete today.
Martin Fayulu is the presidential candidate of the coalition of four opposition political parties in the DRC. He was speaking with me from the capital, Kinshasa. Togolese are voting today in a controversial parliamentary election. A coalition of 14 political parties is boycotting today's vote because they say President Faure Gnassingbé, in power since 2005, has failed to implement key provisions of a roadmap put in place by the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS. But Gilbert Bawara, Togo's Minister for Public Administration, says the election will go ahead as planned because the government has taken the necessary steps to make sure that all political parties can participate.
Definitely. I think there's no doubt that the election is taking place, and even the process has already been very active, because one day ago, the military and policemen have already gone to vote. So this question does not have any sense anymore.
Well, Gilbert, as you know, the alliance of 14 opposition parties are boycotting these elections because they say that they are not going to be free and fair because, number one, your government controls the Elections Commission, and because also your government has failed to meet the benchmark set out by the Economic Community of West African States.
No, I don't think so. You know, the next coming summit of the head of state of the ECOWAS will take place in 2 days, and the head of state will have the opportunity to appreciate and make the evaluation of the implementation of the roadmap on the Togolese and social political situation. So it will be up to the head of state to say if the roadmap has been fulfilled or not. Regarding the Electoral Commission, all the effort has been done to make sure that all the stakeholders can take part in it. And the coalition decided not to participate. There was no way for the government to oblige them to participate. They have the right to participate, but they are not obliged to participate. But there are other political parties and actors who are participating, and the election is taking place in accordance with the roadmap set up by the head of state and government of the ECOWAS. So I don't have any doubt that those head of state will also approve what have been done and implemented until now.
One of the reasons that the opposition believes that these elections are not going to be free and fair, for number one, they claim that your government has failed to release political prisoners that you have in jail, because that was part of the ECOWAS demand. First of all, do you have these political prisoners in jail?
No, we don't have any political prisoners in jail. People have been arrested not because they participated in a demonstration, but because they committed acts that are not allowed by the law. And the roadmap of the ECOWAS did not ask to release them without the trial and the judicial proceedings. The roadmap has requested that the judicial proceedings should be accelerated. This is what we have done. And I'm convinced that the President Faure will also take additional measure of appeasement in the next coming days.
Gilbert Bawara is Togo's Minister for Public Administration. He was speaking with me from the capital, Lomé. The leader of Togo's 14-party opposition coalition says he's disappointed in the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, because the regional group has failed to take a stronger action against the failure of the Togolese government to implement reforms prescribed by ECOWAS. But Jean-Pierre Fabre, leader of Togo's main opposition party, the National Alliance for Change, says the Togolese people will continue to press for constitutional and electoral reforms.
Because the ECOWAS roadmap is not satisfied, and we decided not to be part of this election. And this election are a nonsense, because in the dialogue we are two. And one of the two protagonists in the dialogue didn't participate to these elections. And ECOWAS is not saying anything. This is a very strange attitude from ECOWAS.
Maybe ECOWAS would have liked for you to take part in the election before you can continue to discuss the roadmap.
You know, we know what is good for us. ECOWAS has just stopped a movement which wanted the return of the Constitution of 92. Just what we wanted is the reform, constitutional, institutional, and electoral reforms before going to elections. Now, there are no reforms, and the elections are going on. It's something very strange.
I know the last time I spoke to Brigitte, she said that you had a meeting with the front man for ECOWAS. Are you saying you are not satisfied?
I think we have explained everything to the president, and we are expecting from him and President Alpha Conde to stop the preparation of these elections. That has not been done, and it is a very strange attitude from ECOWAS and from both presidents.
I understand ECOWAS is supposed to be meeting soon. What message do you want to give them?
No message. I am just very frustrated, disappointed. I have no message. They know what they have done.
I was speaking to someone from the government. He said that the government gave you, the opposition, all the opportunity to participate in this election.
They are liars. We have nothing to say. We will continue the demonstrations, and everybody will understand what is going on. Everybody, ECOWAS, everybody, because we are terrorist people. We know what we are suffering, and we will not accept those kind of things.
Mr. Jean-Pierre Fabre, I appreciate very much, and happy holidays to you.
Thank you very much.
Jean-Pierre Fabre is leader of Togo's main opposition, the National Alliance for Change. You're speaking with me from the capital, Lomé. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barton in Washington. Today is Thursday, December 20th. Daybreak Africa time is 17 minutes past the hour. The East African Legislative Assembly has called on the Ugandan government to allow refugees from member states who are not willing to return to their home countries to establish themselves in Uganda. This comes after Uganda is considering to get loans in order to meet the needs of the rising refugee population in the country. Moses Javier Rimana reports from Arusha, Tanzania.
Uganda has experienced an increase in the number of refugees from 430,000 in 2015 to 1 million in 2016 and 1.3 million in 2017. According to the UN Refugee Agency, Uganda hosts 1.1 million refugees, with more than 70% of them coming from the East African Community member states. Victor Burikukie is the chairman of the Committee on Regional Affairs and Conflict Resolution in the Regional Assembly.
The influx of refugees into Uganda has reached unprecedented levels that require an urgent need for the Council of Ministers to find and adopt permanent and urgent solutions.
According to the Ugandan government, 68% of the refugees come from South Sudan, fleeing political dispute between President Salva Kiir and Riek Machar, which sparked a war in December 2013. More than 50,000 people have died from the conflict. The East African Community lawmakers called for member states to respect the East African Community Treaty, which calls for member states to maintain peace and security in the region. The Assembly notes that insecurity has been the major cause of the refugee influx. Matthias Kasamba is a lawmaker from Uganda.
Our brothers and sisters who are suffering in the camps because of our failure in our internal mechanism to resolve conflicts, to give happiness to the people under our jurisdiction. We are here together, well integrated, talking to each other, but beneath us, the magma is boiling our people. It is very painful, and it should be condemned.
Uganda comes third as a refugee-hosting country worldwide, as the country maintains its open-door policy to refugees. But recently, Uganda said it will review the status of some refugees who have stayed in the country for decades. Oburu Oginga is an MP in the regional parliament.
I hope that the common market protocol, when fully implemented, which gives East Africans a right to go to any country and settle, and work will enable us to settle part of this problem of refugee influx into one member country.
According to the East African Community Common Market Protocol that was signed by all member states more than 7 years ago, East Africans have the right to freely move within the region as well as settle down in any member state should they wish to do so. As the majority of the refugees still feel unsafe to return to their home country, the region is now looking for a harmonized national policy and laws of refugees management in the East African community. Moses Saviarimana, VOA Africa, Arusha, Tanzania.
The Missing Migrants Project says 1,386 migrants died in Africa in 2018, though they caution that this number is probably much lower than the actual number of people who perished trying to cross international borders. Amid signing of the Global Compact for Migration, which happened this week, researchers at the UN-backed Missing Migrants Project say more needs to be done globally to create safe and legal routes for migration. Julia Black is project coordinator.
Our project aims to sort of bear witness to these deaths because, simply put, there is no one else counting these deaths and accounting, drawn attention to this issue to the point of it becoming a major political issue and one that is actually included in the new Global Compact for Migration explicitly, that Objective 8 is to save lives.
What is your take on the new compact for migration that was signed? But also, what do you think needs to happen for people to stop going missing? It obviously needs to be counted. I mean, obviously, your ultimate goal is that this doesn't happen anymore.
Right. So the Global Compact for Migration is a non-legal document. So states are sort of saying that they like the idea of this, but there is no really enforcement mechanism in place at this point. And so one thing that we have consistently advocated for over the years is for states to cooperate internationally to provide safe legal routes for migration. Overwhelmingly, like 99.9% of the deaths that we occur during irregular migration and are due to completely preventable causes of death, you know, such as illness or lack of access to medicine, drowning in a route that they don't need to cross if they could just fly there, and so on. And so what we really try to stress, and what I think is in the Global Compact, is that states should provide more safe legal routes so that migrant deaths decrease.
More than just also providing safe and legal routes for migration, safe and legal routes for traveling to and from these regions, do you think that, is that part of it as well, in addition calling for safe and legal routes to migrate, but also just safe and legal routes to go back and forth?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think quite a lot of the people who do move irregularly intend to do so only temporarily. We know this is absolutely the case in the United States, where there's quite a lot of seasonal return or circular migration. So absolutely providing more safe legal to not only migration but return home is absolutely crucial.
So this year, in 2018, according to your website, there have been 1,386 deaths of migrants in Africa. This is down slightly from around almost 1,700 the year before. Do you think this is a noticeable difference, a noticeable decrease based on certain actions, or is just a happenstance?
I don't think you can draw anything from our data in terms of trends over time. What we say consistently is that our data represent minimum estimates. Measuring any phenomena related to irregular migration is extremely difficult, and particularly in Africa, there are very strong indications that many, many more deaths occur during migration than we currently record.
That was Julia Black, coordinator for the Missing Migrants Project. She was speaking to Ricky Stryaki from Berlin, Germany. Generator use in Nigeria is on the rise because of constant power outages. Nigerian businesses spent more than half their budgets on generators every year, according to the country's Rural Electrification Agency. The reliance on generators is believed to contribute significantly to greenhouse gas emissions, a main topic of discussion at this week's climate change conference in Poland. Timothy Obiezu has more from Abuja.
The noise from generators is synonymous with every business area in Nigeria. Ayobami Michael is preparing to get on with his regular workday at his business center in the capital, Abuja, with his daily ritual. He turns on his generator so he's able to power his photocopying and printing machines. But relying on this alternative source of power is expensive.
If you can see now, the light has been so bad since yesterday now. It has been so bad for me. I could not do any work seriously like that. I just have to go down to the police station and get petrol.
Most businesses like Michael's here in Nigeria depend on generators so they can operate. Nigerian businesses collectively spend an estimated $14 billion annually on generators, either importing, fueling or maintaining them. But while generators are costing businesses, generator dealers like Arinze Sebunam say business looks good.
I used to sell the electronics, but I see that more demands are coming on generators. Then I have to stop some television and other things and focus more on generators, because more people, just like today, are sold more than three.
Only 18% of the electricity generated in Nigeria is from renewable sources like solar power and wind. Aside from the noise, they also release harmful gases like carbon monoxide into the atmosphere. Experts accuse the government of neglecting to develop the alternative energy sector, despite the economic repercussions of heavy dependence on generators. Jaye Gaskia is an energy expert and economist.
Every household has a generator. Every small, medium, micro enterprise has a generator. Every big firm, corporation, not only have generators, they actually have power plants, their own power plants. But none of this is integrated into the national grid, so none of this is available publicly, which is what makes the economic sense not to be really sensible, not to be rational. And the impact that this has is that it's one of the key reasons why the cost of doing business in Nigeria is one of the highest in the world.
Nigeria's President Muhammadu Buhari is among 20,000 delegates who attended the Climate Change Summit in Poland this month. The goal is for each nation to reduce greenhouse gas to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. But Nigeria is Africa's top oil producer, as well as the biggest importer of fossil fuel-powered generators. Experts say it will not be easy for President Buhari to eliminate the existing generators from over 60 million households. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. With two more days to go before the decisive December 23rd presidential election in the Democratic Republic of Congo, the governor of Kinshasa has banned campaigning in the capital. Campaign was due to end at midnight tomorrow, Friday. Governor Andre Kimbuta, a member of Congo's ruling coalition, says the ban is necessary because he is in possession of information that extremists in the camps of the main candidates were preparing for street confrontation in Kinshasa. But Martin Fayulu, the presidential candidate of a coalition of four opposition parties, says the ban is an illegal one targeted only towards him. He says his lawyer will go to court today to sue the mayor of Kinshasa. And Togolese are voting today in a controversial parliamentary election. A coalition of 14 political parties is boycotting today's vote because they say President Faure Gnassingbé, in power since 2005, has failed to implement key provisions of a roadmap put in place by the Economic Community of West African States. That's it for this Thursday, December 20th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, along with our engineer John Ellison, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you a good day.
Want to relax, unwind, or charge up? Then listen to Music Time in Africa this weekend. It'll do all that for you and more. I'm Heather Maxwell. I know good music. And Africa is my passion. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for 1 hour of commercial-free Pan-African music of the highest caliber. You get great music, music news, and amazing artist interviews from rising stars to superstars. This listen will take you places. So do it. Join me for Music Time in Africa, your weekend destination.